since 1995. My film team and I are going to Paris to meet the people who are deciding about our future.
Guardians of the Earth, Part 3.
Night has fallen, and the COP venue is calm for the moment. Skepticism continues to grow, and the numbers make clear why. The current text still has 1,585 square brackets and issues to be resolved. There are 9 days left.
The initial assessment showed that Haiyan left a wake of massive destruction that is unprecedented, unthinkable. Mr. President, I speak for my delegation, but I speak for the countless people who will no longer be able to speak for themselves. Now, Mr. President, if you will allow me, Super Typhoon Haiyan made landfall in my own family's hometown, and the devastation.
After Marso, without me knowing the full reason behind it, I was taken out of the Philippine delegation. So it's not as if I walked away from the process. I was taken out. And if I was taken out because I have been vocal about rich nations having to take responsibility and about the fossil fuel industry being the biggest problem that stands in the way, that should give me a lot of pride to be taken out. Because climate change is a battle that will not be won or lost in the conference halls here.
I've always said the climate change negotiation stopped being about climate change a long time ago. It's about economy. It's about interests. It's about who pays for your election campaign. Fortunately, what we're seeing now is the business sector is ahead of the politicians. They're changing. They're turning around.
We pay a visit to COP Solutions, an exhibition where businesses tell us how they intend to take part in solving the climate crisis. Among them are the world's biggest banks and energy-producing corporations, which are also sponsoring COP.
This place is a corporate greenwashing exercise, and they're not allowing us to say so. These organizations have paid up to 250,000 euros to have not just a stand in here, but political influence. Engie and these companies, you're not part of the solution. And it seems the only way that you can make your voice heard when you haven't got 250,000 euros is to do something like this. Take direct action, make a noise, and actually make our voices heard. Money will not silence the people, and we will be heard. But unfortunately, money can buy you quite a lot of security. So we're going to be taken out, but it does not end here. We're going to continue. We're going to be in the streets. We're going to be on the front lines. We're going to take down Engie and the others whilst they are in our communities, and we're going to make sure that actually our climate future is in the hands of people and not big business.
From an insider, we receive information on how successful lobbying works. We learn, for example, that negotiators have given in to the aviation industry's demands and removed text that would have limited pollution from airplanes.
We are very pleased to see that within the last few days there's been a tremendous amount of momentum and support from civil society, from the world, and indeed from a number of countries, including developed and developing countries. And we hope that by the next few days we will complete an agreement that recognizes 1.5 degrees, but not only that, the means to achieve that. Do you have a microphone over there?
What kind of response are you seeing, particularly from oil-producing countries, to this goal of 1.5 degrees?
Thank you very much, Suzanne. I'm going to invite Wael Maidan to answer the question.
Yes, it's unfortunate that the Arab group is the mainly only group that is opposing 1.5, and this is surprising because part of the Arab region is supporting 1.5. Now, how much we'd be able to have a complete shift, and including Saudi Arabia accepting 1.5, it's going to be part of the trade-offs that could possibly happen.
Ladies and gentlemen, I wish to make an announcement that we're not here to accept the minimalist Paris Agreement. So every minister standing on this stage has joined the Ambition Coalition, and we will fight to protect the ambition in the agreement.
I have a question about the EU, who is part of this coalition but not present now. Can you explain why?
President of the EU is here.
Yes,
Yes, hello. It's for us normal to be on the Ambition Coalition because we need a long-term target. We need tools that can operationalize this target so the EU is present from the beginning.
Thank you, Madam President. Thank you very, very much for that. We will need to go now. Thank you very much.
What we are calling the High Ambition Coalition. This is a group of countries that is fully committed to ensuring that the agreement is a truly ambitious one. You know, this is not a situation where we have to hope and pray that some smart person is going to come along and find the solution. No, we already have the solution. The solution to climate change is energy policy. Sure, we're going to continue to pump gas and oil for years. We know that. We're not going to leave here knowing that everything we do is going to hit the 2-degree mark. But what we're doing is sending the marketplace an extraordinary signal that those 186 countries are really committed. And that helps the private sector to move capital into that, knowing there's a future that is committed to this sustainable path.
Targets that they have brought to this summit lead us to an extremely dangerous world. They don't lead us to 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius. For setting a target of warming that may allow the low-lying Pacific Islands to survive, and I say may, our governments are demanding that those countries explicitly give up their right to seek loss and damages for climate change. It says it in the text right now.
The negotiators haven't slept for the past 2 days, with the talks continuing behind closed doors 24/7.
I'm hoping we preserve the high ambition elements, which are still in the text, in everything. But as they wheel and deal and compromise, there's a tendency to give up things. And right now, in the next few hours, I predict there'll be moves to jettison as much of it as possible, because that's how you get compromise. You get compromise by agreeing to the lowest common denominator, not by going to the upper end of the ambition. Then the bits that are easiest to sacrifice are the bits that the vulnerable and the poorest countries hold dearest, but they're the ones who have least leverage in holding on to stuff. I'm very afraid that we will start losing all the ambitious language that's in the text now.
At 4 o'clock in the morning, the COP president calls an emergency meeting to resolve the conflict about the final wording of the agreement. The majority of countries demand 1.5 in the text, but a single veto can block this demand. This meeting is closed to the public, but we've managed to sneak inside.
Saudi Arabia, Indonesia, short speeches, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. We are of the view that it should read as follows. Hold the increase in the global average temperature to below 2 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. Full stop. And again, the word shall, should, would like to see may in that article. With that, Mr. President, I should thank you.
Well, Mr. President, We appreciate your leadership enormously. This agreement, I have to tell you, my friends, this is a monument to differentiation. This is the single most differentiated agreement I've ever seen in my life because of the 186 voluntary, nationally determined plans. I hope we'll look very carefully and not get hung up over word for word that don't really have an impact. I mean, I'll give you an example. All parties should strive to formulate and communicate long-term low greenhouse gas emission development strategies. Now, it's been recommended that that be deleted. I find it really hard to understand how the word strive threatens anybody. We can't afford, in the hours we have left and in the time we have, and given the spirit with which we've all come here, to nitpick every single word of this agreement. I don't believe that's where we are. Thank you, Mr. President.
My schedule is this one. Today, Friday, I will try to pull the pieces together, and I will consult the different groups during the day, not right now, but during the day. And I will be in a position to present a text, which will be the final text, tomorrow. Thank you very much.
In a desperate decision, the United Nations extends the negotiations by one day. Everybody's exhausted, and time's running out to reach the necessary agreement. The COP president makes a last-ditch attempt to bring the opposed sides together in secret talks.
I'm off.
Okay. Good.
Good. Well done. Well done. You should be proud.
Yes.
You should be proud.
I thought
it was a good fight.
Package.
Yeah.
It is good.
It is a good fight.
What do you want more than that?
Exactly. Exactly.
And no, it's the core thing.
It's very good.
Yes.
It's a good agreement for us.
Yes, I think it's a good agreement.
Okay.
For the LDCs and developing countries.
I did what I could. You did it yourself.
Yeah.
But I'm happy to help.
Yes,
today we had a historic agreement, 1.5 degree long-term goal, despite the fact that all the rich countries and all the big developing countries did not want it when they had come to Paris. We made them change their mind.
For the first time in history, 195 nations have settled on a global agreement. Its stated objective? To limit the increase in the global average temperature to well below 2 degrees Celsius and pursue efforts to limit the temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius. The Paris Agreement shall remain in effect for the coming decades. Its success depends on the national action plans of each and every country. But the new administration in the United States is strongly opposed to the UN's multilateral approach.
This agreement gives foreign bureaucrats control over how much our energy and how much we use right here in America. So foreign bureaucrats are going to be controlling what we're using and what we're doing on our land in our country. No way. We're going to cancel the Paris Climate Agreement and stop all payments of the United States tax dollars to UN global warming programs.
In order to reach the 1.5 degree target, worldwide emissions have to be drastically reduced by 2020. The United States of America is responsible for almost one-third of these emissions.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Deen al-Islam, deeni, wa'adhu ghayru deeni, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jalad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Before we deal with the law of miscellaneous nature, which is the topic today, and inshallah in the upcoming episodes, let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Sistani.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hawza lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Back to the program Islamic Law on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and our dear guest speaker, as always in the studio, sitting with me, Sheikh Javid. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the studio again.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me on this program.
Welcome. Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about, Ayatollah Sistani's fatwas about these issues that we are talking about, and in the previous episode, we started talking about kosher and the jurisprudential status of what a kosher is and what it is, in fact, to Muslims when it comes to eating. Would you tell our audience about the general status of the food which are in the non-Muslim countries, especially in the countries where there are lots of non-believers, you know, or disbelievers. So how can Muslims go about such food?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, we have to classify non-Muslims into two groups.
Mm-hmm.
One being the people of the book.
Yes.
And the other, the atheists, the pagans, the Buddhists, Sikhs, and these people who do not believe in an Abrahamic religion or in a divine religion.
Mm-hmm.
So Islam differentiates between these two categories of non-Muslims. Okay, when it comes to the people of the book, they are ritually pure.
Yes,
and Muslims can easily interact with them. They can have given. And take relationship with the people of the book. They are better known as Ahle Kitab.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously it's permissible to eat their food. It's permissible to eat from the same plate and to share your food with the people of the book.
Right.
They are not najis or ritually impure. So it's always easy to interact with Christians, with Jews, and with Zoroastrians, according to Ayatollah Sistani, because according to his eminence,
mm-hmm.
Zoroastrians are also the people of the book.
Mm-hmm.
They are followers of a divine religion.
Right.
But this is obviously contentious,
mm-hmm.
and many scholars and many Muslims have contradicted this issue. Or
yes.
This, yeah. Now, when it comes to the food served by Christians, of course we can eat the food given by them by the people of the book, and we do need to investigate whether the food is impure or not. As long as the food does not contain meat,
mm-hmm.
as long as the food does not contain any animal ingredients, we are allowed to eat that food.
By animal ingredient, you mean?
Okay, animal fat.
Uh-huh.
Animal fat is there. Of course, there are other ingredients which come originally from animals. And
what about eggs?
Eggs are halal, you know. If they come from chicken, they are halal.
Yeah, if they come from chicken, but you know, lots of birds are not halal. So
you know,
if their eggs come to the market, then.
When we talk about eggs that come from chicken are easily, I think, you can
recognize them.
You can tell that these eggs are eggs of a chicken, not of a crow or let's say an eagle or something like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So eggs are halal as long as you establish as long as you're certain that the eggs are come from a chicken.
Mm-hmm.
See. But speaking about food, about meals in Western, in European or in American restaurants, of
mm-hmm.
course, because majority of the people there are Christians, it's not necessary to ask the individual who touches the food whether he is a Buddhist or a Christian. You can consider those non-Muslims as Christians, as people of the book, because the majority of the people there are people of the book.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, when you come across a non-Muslim person, it is not necessary to consider. It's not necessary to ask him whether he is a Christian or a Buddhist or a Sikh or someone. Okay, you can treat him as
a member of the majority,
as a member of the majority, and therefore. It's not necessary to ask. This is the main issue to
right.
To understand and to take notice of. And then the food that he gives you, if you are sure that the food has been touched by him. For example, if he brings you vegetable and he has washed the vegetable, or he has washed the dishes with naked hands,
mm-hmm.
Or he has touched the food in the state of wetness, the food is treated as halal, as permissible,
even if
it is wet, of course, yeah, because the people of the book are pure,
uh-huh,
pure, ritually pure.
I see,
but it's necessary to
okay.
make sure.
Okay. Let me actually take a break here, and then we'll be back and continue our discussion. Don't go away.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Back to the program Islamic Law on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our dear guest speaker. So, Sheikh Javid, you were speaking just before the break about, you know, the people of the board are ritually pure, so whenever they touch the food, it doesn't make it actually contaminated, ritually speaking.
Yes.
So yeah, you were
of
saying?
Course. There's no cross, you know. You know, there is a term used like cross contamination. That's what we are not talking about it. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Cross contamination can apply when, for example, the cook is cooking pork in one cauldron, and then halal meat in another, and he is using the same spoon,
mm-hmm.
the same utensils, the same cutleries, and
right.
so on and so forth. This cross contamination is may occur. Okay, may occur.
Uh-huh, right.
But
sure.
we are not sure. You are not sure, and we are not duty bound. We are not obliged to investigate, to make sure whether cross contamination has occurred or
yes.
not. Of course. So you can eat the food served in American restaurants and European restaurants, provided that the food does not contain meat mm-hmm. and animal ingredients. That's
right.
for sure. When it comes to the countries with a majority Hindu population like India and many southeastern nations,
mm-hmm.
see, there are also Muslims living in those countries, of course, and those Muslims have greater problem
yes.
As compared to Muslims living in the West, because as a Muslim you are living in a Hindu majority community.
Right.
And you interact with them. Of course, interaction is something inevitable. You have to do business with them. You have to sell things to them and also buy things from
yes.
them. That's for sure. But when it comes to eating their food, Grand Ayatollah Sistani is of the opinion that as long as you do not know that the food is najis, is impure,
mm-hmm.
and in so far as the food does not contain, let's say, meat. And these things, then
or the meat products,
it is permissible to eat the food,
right?
Because Muslims, okay, for example, Muslims are traveling from one province to another province. Let's say a Shia Muslim, travels from Bihar to Bombay in India.
Yes,
so he travels a long way, and he is, of course, he has to go to Bombay with few Muslim population. He cannot find any hotel, any restaurant. So what should he do? He should eat the food that he does not know that he doesn't know to be
mm-hmm.
to be impure.
Yes.
So there's also one important thing to note, and that is Hindus are ritually impure. Sikhs are ritually impure. If we know that they have touched something
yes.
in the state of wetness, for example, with his hand
mm-hmm.
being wet,
yes.
or with the object being wet, and the touching has taken place,
yes.
we cannot use that thing, whether it's for prayer, whether it's for eating. For example, if the plate has been washed by a Hindu with naked hand, you know,
mm-hmm.
we cannot use it. And if the vegetable that you are going to eat has been washed by a Hindu without using gloves, okay, you cannot eat that.
Or kitchen utensils.
Kitchen utensils. And there are Muslims having Hindu roommates.
Right.
Hindu roommates.
Mm-hmm.
They live in the same room. They use the same bathroom, the same, washroom, you know.
Yes.
So they cannot go against what they have seen, because when you see something, then that brings you the certainty.
Exactly.
And you cannot go against what you have seen.
Okay.
So things that are impure must be avoided.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. I hope you enjoyed this show, and you keep us in your du'as. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم فلا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The United Nations organization is supposed to be strictly neutral and to spare no efforts in brokering peace between or among its member states without taking sides with any party. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading UN Policies Expand Theater of Yemen War into UAE. Stay tuned for more. The United Nations organization is supposed to be strictly neutral and to spare no efforts in brokering peace between or among its member states without taking sides with any party. This appears fine on paper, especially on the UN Charter, but in practice, the so-called world body has long deviated from its goals and allowed itself to be used as a tool for serving the vested interests of some of its founding members, especially the US. We in Iran suffered this stepmotherly treatment during the eight-year war the United States had imposed upon us in 1980s through Saddam of the repressive Ba'ath minority regime of Baghdad. Neither the bloodthirsty dictator's frequent attacks on ships, railways, buses and planes were condemned, nor his targeting of city centers and use of chemical weapons, let alone the denunciation of the US for its role in openly siding with Saddam in the war imposed upon the Islamic Republic. This same negative attitude of the UN towards the oppressed Palestinian people over the past 74 years is now fully evident in Yemen, where for the past 7 years, the Arab world's most impoverished country is subjected to the US-backed Saudi-UAE invasion that has destroyed the infrastructure and killed almost 400,000 men, women, and children. The UN, instead of naming the aggressors and demanding end of aggression, calls Yemen's defenders rebels for protecting their homeland and has banned any supply of weapons to them, while turning a blind eye to the massive flow of lethal American, British, and French armaments to Riyadh and Abu Dhabi to continue more crimes against humanity. The other day, it urged Yemen's government in Sana'a to release a UAE ship, which had been impounded for carrying sophisticated weapons to the mercenaries prolonging the war. The Yemeni government has rightfully rejected the release of Rawabi, which was carrying military equipment, and charged the UN of siding with murderers who violate international law. Sana'a also deplored the hypocrisy of the world body for its refusal to criticize the continued bombing of Yemeni towns and cities by the Saudi Air Force and the active involvement of the UAE to fuel the flames of war in Shabwa, Ma'arib, and other regions. After due warnings to the UAE to desist from its destabilizing role in Yemen, the popular Ansarullah movements had no other choice but to retaliate by targeting industrial and military sites in Abu Dhabi while destroying a UAE military transport plane in Shabwa in central Yemen. This means, because of the dubious policies of the UN, the theater of the seven-year war is expanding and may cause death and destruction on a wide scale in the Persian Gulf region that accounts for 20% of the world's crude oil supplies. The death that occurred at Abu Dhabi International Airport and in the Musaffah industrial area, where three oil tankers were set ablaze through precision strikes, rests solely on the UN shoulders. If the UAE continues its sedition in Yemen, then it should brace for more such drone or ballistic missile attacks that would trigger a massive exodus back home of foreign workers along with economic collapse, all because of the negative role of the United Nations organization.
The last savior.
Oh, the savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Light of Allah, you are our true guide.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
We're waiting for you to be my.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is your humble host, Zainab. Dear listeners, this is the program The Last Savior, and we had been talking about the false claimants of Mehdi. Either they say they are Mehdi themselves, or they say they are one or the other way attached to Imam Mehdi, ajallullah ta'ala faraja. Now, we had been analyzing the tricks that were being used by these false claimants in the previous episodes, and now in this episode as well, we'll analyze some more tricks so that people may be more and more aware and very much cautious not to get entrapped into these tricks. And on that note, today in our studio, we have had the pleasure again invite Dr. Murtaza Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Doctor.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Thank you so much for accepting the invitation again.
My pleasure.
Dr. Karimi, as we had been talking about these tricks, I get back to the fact that, you know, it's always said that prevention is better than cure in terms of health. So here also people need to be aware about the tricks so that they do not get trapped into these tricks. And after these getting trapped, the cure is really hard. So that's why prevention is better than cure even here. And this famous quote was said by Imam Ali al-Islam basically. I would want you to analyze some more tricks that are being used by these claimants in order to trap people.
Sure. The next one that I would like to mention might seem at the first glance very weird, but when we go into it deeply, we come to this conclusion that these people very purposefully they have chosen this technique. And that is the fact that many of these movements run by these false claimants, we see that they are inviting the people to be away from the religious scholars. Why? Because we know that in the whole history of Islam, the main enemies to these false claimants were the scholars. And that is why they also, these false claimants, they tried to ask the people to be away, ask their followers to be away from the religious scholars, and even they call the religious scholars as, I mean, deviant people.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Wherein the Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, says that they are our, we call in Persian as Janishin.
Yeah, kind of.
The religious scholars, even in one of the narrations, Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, says that may Allah's mercy be on these people, these religious scholars, who are spreading Islam,
yeah, general successes, and
who are spreading the truth, basically. And since these people who are religious scholars are obviously open enemies to these claimants, and that's where the first thing is.
That's that exactly
to stay away from these people.
Yeah, that's exactly the philosophy and the wisdom behind that. Let me just quote and refer to some stories and events in this regard, and you see that how they try to make their followers away from the religious scholars. Regarding the Baha'i school of thought or Baha'ism, he was, Hussein Ali Baha, one of the key figures, he was so a serious enemy to the scholars that it is mentioned that he never sat on a minbar, on a pulpit. Mm-hmm. Because he said that this is the place for these people, for these so-called scholars, and even I'm not going to sit on the same place. According to him, whenever he compared the scholars of his time to Pharaoh at the time of Prophet Musa alayhissalam, and he called the scholars as the Pharaoh or the Pharaohs of his
times.
Time. Yeah. He also called the scholars as the thieves of the true path. Not only that, they mentioned that, according to some of the key figures in Baha'ism, that the main reason for the fact that we have some deviation in the religion of Islam is the corruption of the religious scholars. If we have some innovations in Islamic society, it is because of the so-called scholars, and so on and so forth. And the same can be seen in the sayings of many other false claimants. Another one, again, I'm not going to mention his name, he says that, you see, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is not going to reappear. You know why we are not able to take benefit from the Imam of the time? Do you know what is the reason of all these fitnas and problems and the
troubles
fact that,
around?
Yeah, and troubles. And do you see all these vices which are widespread among the Shia, and so on and so forth? He mentions all of them, and then he says that the main cause for all these problems are the religious scholars.
Oh my God.
This is the viewpoint of this person. And when it comes to these false claimants from Basra, again, he's a very, I mean, harsh enemy to the religious scholars, and I mean, explicitly he has mentioned that. But as you rightly mentioned, there are many narrations in our sources, I mean, from the Prophet and the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, asking the Shia to just, I mean, follow these religious scholars. Not only that, we see that the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, sometimes they appointed some of their companions, who were the religious scholars, to, for example, sit in the mosque of the Prophet and give fatwa, give the Islamic verdict
meaning that the Imam trusts him so much that he says that just sit in the mosque and do not quote narration from me. You yourself are able to give the Islamic rule for the people. Mm-hmm. In many cases, the Imams of the Ahl Bayt, when they were asked to debate regarding different Islamic issues, they asked their companions to do that, which means that they trusted them the most.
In fact, it is stated that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, the school of thought basically expanded in his time, basically sets up a university wherein he introduces so many courses, introduces so many subjects of Islam, and then he sees which student is best at which subject, and then arranges debates in between them and always gives them time to go for conferences, to give lectures and all. That means Imam here is basically encouraging these people to come up and start speaking.
And not only that, there are narrations talking about the religious scholars during the major occultation. In one narration, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam says that if it was not for the existence of scholars at the time of major occultations, so that people may refer to them and ask their questions and they defend the religion of Islam, then all the people would abandon belief in religion and become apostate. So the reason that people continue to believe in the religion of Islam and the Shia school of thought is the fact that we have all these religious scholars during the major occultation. So again, if we see any person asking the people to be away from the religious scholars, it is again a sign for the fact that he is just a liar
again. Alright, Dr. Karimi, we'll be talking to you. Here we need to take a short break. The listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever.
And the last trick that in this series of the sessions I would like to mention is also unfortunately very misleading, and it is about the titles given by these false claimants to those simple-minded people. Imagine a false claimant, he has some claims to be Imam or the gate to the Imam. Some people come to believe in him, and then he addressing those people, he gives them some great names and titles. So that person would feel, so much delighted that I was given this title by this person who is Imam Mahdi or a deputy of the Imam. So
he'll be on the cloud nine.
Yeah, exactly. He will have a great confidence, and he would or she would believe in him even more than before. So this is one of the tricks used by these false claimants, just to give without any justification, haphazardly, any title to different people. Let me share some of these titles which are interesting. For example, one of these false claimants, contemporary one, he calls his followers that you are the people of the cave for me. So without any reason, we know how great the people of the cave, Ashab al-Kahf, are. So he just mentioned and introduces his followers and companions as the people of the cave.
And people get flattered.
Yeah, that's the point. In another person, addressing a lady who believes in one of these false claimants, he says the following: you are, oh my sister, the honor for Islam. You are a great mystic. You are one of the brilliant stars in the sky of truth.
Oh my God.
And you are the Zahra of the time.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I don't know how people believe in that, but there is no comparison with Lady Zahra. Not even the dust of her feet.
Sure.
Nobody. Like, I don't know. We have so many great scholars today. And people, you know, people kill themselves to reach mysticism. And this person is simply labeling this lady as a mystic.
Yeah, maybe one of the reasons is that, these people in some cases at least, they are suffering from some psychological disorder
some
when it comes
distress.
To their personality. So as soon as a person pays attention to them, giving them such titles,
exactly.
then
more
they believe
seekers,
in him.
Basically.
And that is why these people, they are using this trick. So again, people should be aware when we hear such terms, which as you rightly mentioned, to be the Zahra of the time is not something to be claimed
really
even
different.
For any woman, even be it Lady Khadija salamullahi alayha or Asliya, no woman can be likened to Lady Zahra salamullahi alayha, who is Sayyidatun Nisa'il Alameen,
exactly.
the mistress of all the women in the whole world. I think we mentioned 6 or 7 tricks which are used by these false claimants to deceive the people, like doing istikhara, dream, writing arida, making up some forged family trees, giving titles to other people, and so on and so forth, and also miracles. These are the most important ones and the most widespread one among the false claimants of the Mahdawiyya. From time to time, some new tricks would be used by these people, but these are the most important ones. And we hope that people increase their knowledge and insight about Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. The true ways through which we are able to know the Imam of the time are mentioned in the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. One of them is knowledge. One of them is the fact that he needs to have some of the, for example, weapons which belong to our Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, and the features of these weapons are mentioned in the narrations. So people need to, be very careful when it comes to any person who claims to be the Imam of the time.
And I think we have so many narrations saying that Imam, once he will emerge, it will be in Kaaba, not in Basra or any other place.
Yeah, that's the point. I mean, for the false claimants of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, this is the point, but some of them, they just claim to be deputies of the imams, and it makes the situation
makes
a bit complicated for
yes,
the people.
Yes, it definitely makes when someone says, I am connected to Imam. And like you rightly mentioned in the previous episodes as well, like, I am the intermediate, I'll take Ariza to Imam, I'll take your letter to Imam, and like...
Just let me repeat one sentence, that whoever claims that I'm able to see Imam Mahdi alayhi salam whenever I want, I'm a special deputy of the Imam, he is just a liar. This is something for sure that, this is a reality mentioned in many narrations of the Ahlul. So whoever claims to be a special deputy or intermediary between the people and the Imam...
So we cannot accept the claim that our people, they meet Imam whenever they like, whenever they want. So there's nothing like that, and we need to be aware, we need to take care of these things. Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi, for being with us. Dear listeners, that was all for today. Thank you so much for being with us. Until then, this is Zainab Askari with her whole team saying goodbye.
Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest glow?
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.